Good morning, folks. How is everyone today? My work is slowly piling up and I have so many interviews and videos to bring up. Don't know when I'm going to be up to date. But today I present before you a discussion I had late in May, about a week ago, with Dr. Dave Goulson of Sussex University in UK. And why did I speak with him? Well, it has to do with this neonicotinoid pesticide or insecticide that is suspected to be behind the collapse of the bee population around the world, and the fact that many EU countries have banned this pesticide or this insecticide for the coming years, and that was based on a scientific study done on the effect of this insecticide on bee population. And that person who did the scientific study and prepared the paper was Dr. Dave Goulson of Sussex University. And that is how I approached him on email and requested that I should speak with him. And I'm thankful that he agreed. Before I take you to the talk, I'm reading from his biography on the website for Sussex University, University of Sussex, Professor Dave Goulson. And he had a childhood that was chasing butterflies and collecting birds' eggs. Lovely. And then he studied biology at Oxford University and then did his PhD on butterfly ecology at Oxford Brookes University. Shortly afterwards, he got a lectureship at University of Southampton, where he stayed more than a decade. And it was there that he began to specialize in bee ecology and conservation, particularly bumblebees. And in 2006, he became the professor of biology at Stirling University, and he founded the Bumblebee Conservation Trust. That's a charity devoted to reversing the bumblebee decline. And in 2013, this year, he moved to Sussex University. He has published over 200 scientific articles on ecology of bees and other insects, and he's an author of Bumblebees, Their Behavior, Ecology, and Conservation, which came out in 2010 from Oxford University Press. And then he wrote another book, A Sting in the Tail, which is just now released in this year, a popular science book on bumblebees. We'll come to that book a little later. He is a fellow of Royal Entomological Society and a fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh. And in 2010, he was BBSRC Social Innovator of the Year. And in 2013, this is this year, he won the Marsh Award for Conservation Biology from the Zoological Society of London. I hope you all can join me in a collective wow. So I ended up asking him to explain what is pesticide or insecticide, or what is this neonicotinoid thing? And this is what he had to say, and this is how the conversation went.
What is a pesticide? A pesticide is something that kills pests, I guess. Definition I've never even thought about, but so neonicotinoids are insecticides specifically, so they're chemicals that are designed to kill insects, although they are toxic to some degree to other animals like us, but they're very, very toxic to insects. They're neurotoxins, so they act on the brain of the insect, and if you give them enough, it causes paralysis and death fairly swiftly, and enough is not very much. So the LD50, for example, the dose that kills 50% of test insects for honeybees, for one of the commonest of these compounds, clothianidin, is 4 nanograms per bee, so 4 billionths of a gram.
I see. And this insecticide, was it developed to kill bees, or was it developed to kill something else and it is also killing bees?
They certainly weren't developed to kill bees. No, they basically kill insects, and the same is true of almost all insecticides. They tend not to be specific to any particular group of insects. They just kill a lot. So are intended to kill primarily insects that feed on crops. So herbivorous pest insects like caterpillars and aphids and so on.
I see. And so that there is a collateral damage, if I may use that term, on insects that are not destroying the crop, but also beneficial to not just to humans, but to the environment, can also be affected or die out of this application of this insecticide?
Yeah, although to be fair, that's always been a problem with any insecticide. There is a danger, a likelihood that you will kill, as well as killing the things you want to kill, you will kill beneficial insects, bees, predators of pest insects, and so on. That's true of any insecticide you use, more or less. Some are perhaps a little more likely to kill more beneficial insects than others. But they all kill them one way or another.
I see. And this neonicotinoid, does this insecticide has any connection with nicotine?
Chemically, it's, if you like, a relative of nicotine, hence the name. It's not a... Obviously, nicotine is a naturally occurring chemical. Neonicotinoids are a kind of synthetic variant for the chemist playing around in the lab, tinkering with the molecule and adding bits to it and so on. They are related to nicotine.
I see. And what prompted your group to test this this insecticide, and how did you come to the conclusion? I understand that this is one of the suspected reasons for the collapse of bee population.
Yeah, one of the reasons. I would first of all say that it clearly isn't the sole cause of bee problems. But I think the evidence is reasonably convincing that it's contributing to bee health problems and declines. The reason I started to get involved was because this issue was beginning to attract a lot of attention. But it seemed that the bulk of the evidence suggested that neonicotinoids were likely to be having sublethal effects on bee behavior that wouldn't show up in the standard laboratory or semi-field safety tests done for chemicals. So the basic problem is this, that when bees feed on a crop that's been treated, so it needs to be a flowering crop like canola or corn or whatever, sunflowers, there are small, very low concentrations of neonicotinoids in the nectar and the pollen, so bees consume them. Everyone agrees on that. That's a simple fact. The question is, does the amount they consume cause them harm? And probably the answer is that the amount they're consuming is not enough to kill them. These are neurotoxins, as I said earlier, so they affect the brain of the bee. And bees are pretty unusual insects. They depend on their ability to learn and to navigate. Without that, they've had it. So a worker bee will go out from the hive and it has to search the landscape. It may fly miles to find a patch of flowers. And then it has to learn how to get the rewards out of those flowers quickly and efficiently. And then it has to navigate home again. And it has to do that over and over again in varying weather conditions. And flowers will stop flowering and new ones will start flowering and so on. So they're really quite smart insects in terms of what they're capable of. And evidence had started to appear from lab studies which suggested that exposure to realistic levels of neonicotinoids didn't kill bees, but that it interfered with their ability to learn and to navigate. And if that were the case, it seemed to me that that would only really have a significant impact if you did an experiment in which the bees were actually flying realistic distances. They actually had to go and do what bees normally do, which is fly around the landscape and collect pollen and nectar from flowers. And yet nearly all the studies had been done, the safety testing studies that were used in the first place for these chemicals were mostly done in the lab. Most of the experiments subsequently done by various scientists were done in situations where the bees only had to go maybe a couple of meters to collect food, which isn't terribly challenging, even for a bee that's not on top form, as it were. So it seemed to me quite possible that these behavioural effects could be really important in a natural situation, and what we needed to do was to try and test that. So that's essentially what, a couple of years ago, we set out to do, using bumblebees rather than honeybees, because that's what my group work on. So basically, we exposed bumblebee nests. We tried to simulate them being next to a treated canola crop, which in Europe is the commonest flowering crop that's commonly treated with neonicotinoids. And in Britain, we have many fields of canola, and most bumblebee nests are likely to be within a short flight of one of these fields when it flowers. And so we wanted to know what harm that might be doing to bumblebee nests, if any. So we gave bumblebee nests, we fed them on food that we doctored with the same concentrations of neonicotinoid that you find in the pollen and nectar of a treated canola crop. And we did that for 2 weeks. And then we basically just put the nests outside and let them made them collect their own food. And just we left them alone, essentially, apart from weighing them and monitoring them. And looked to see what difference we got between the colonies that had been exposed to the treated food and control colonies. And we found this really remarkable, huge difference in how well the colonies performed. The treated colonies, essentially, they grew slowly and they produced very, very few queens at the end of the season. So there was an 85% drop in queen production in the treated colonies, which, yeah, was pretty surprising. And I certainly hadn't anticipated an effect that big, but kind of makes sense. If you accept that basically the pesticide appears to be interfering with the ability of the bees to collect food, to go out and navigate and find food and bring it back and so on. And since our study, there have been several more that have essentially corroborated it, in the sense that there's a very nice study that was published from a group based in London in Nature about 6 months ago, which showed that it's particularly pollen collection that suffers when bees are when they're exposed to these very low doses of pesticide. It doesn't kill them, but it means that they become much worse at collecting pollen, which is one of the fiddlier, more challenging jobs that worker bees have to do. We think it's probably easier to collect nectar than it is to collect pollen, because of the manipulation you have to do, or the bee has to do. Certainly for bumblebees, several studies have come out in the last year or so, all of which are pretty consistent and suggest very strongly that the kind of levels of exposure that bees might receive in an arable landscape are enough to have pretty big effects on their colonies. I would have to say, though, that the evidence is not quite so convincing for honeybees. Now, I don't work on honeybees. Bumblebees are the wild relatives of honeybees, but they have much smaller colonies. And certainly I think the evidence is less clear cut for honeybees, essentially, that there haven't been such strong, convincing studies yet performed. And it may be partly because the honeybees have this added complication of the varroa mite, which is this non-native mite which has been accidentally spread around the world. which is also definitely contributing to honeybee problems. And the agrochemical industry would want us to believe that that's the only cause of honeybee health problems. But I think it's almost certainly a combination of factors in the case of honeybees.
I see. That was a very good explanation. Dave, I have some questions further. It might sound naive to you, but for an average listener, bumblebees as against honeybees, I understand that bumblebees feed on pollen and not nectar that honeybees do. Is that correct?
No. They both feed on pollen and nectar. And that's pretty much all they feed on. So they need nectar as their main source of carbohydrate, basically sugars. And they need pollen as their source of protein, particularly for rearing their young. So bumblebees and honeybees are very similar in that respect.
Oh, I see. So okay. So this neonicotinoid, as you said, that its effect on honeybees is not as clear-cut as, in your own words, as bumblebees. Now, when it comes to pollination, natural cross-pollination and pollination of not only crops that we eat, but also for all other kind of plants that the environment needs to have, is honeybees any more important or less important than bumblebees?
It depends on the crop. I mean, and overall, globally, I would say that if you had to, the honeybees are the most numerous species of bee in the world.
Oh, I see.
So they're purely in terms of their abundance. They're more important than any other one species. But 25,000 species of bee in the world, of which the honeybee is just one.
Oh, I see.
And different crops benefit from pollination by different bees. So honeybees are very good for almonds, say, or for citrus. But, for example, for tomatoes or blueberries, bumblebees are much better. And there are other crops like alfalfa, which is better pollinated by alfalfa leafcutter bees, and so on. So I really, all bees are important essentially, and we need to conserve both honeybees and wild bees like bumblebees and solitary bees if we want to ensure that we have good pollination services for crops and that wildflowers set seed.
I see. And this talk that is going around that honeybees are populations are collapsing, is it only happening with honeybees or it is actually a general condition with all kinds of bees?
Well, I'm sorry to say, we don't know for sure because obviously we have good data on how many honeybee hives have died, this winter and so on. But clearly, for the vast majority of wild bee species, nobody is counting how many nests they've got or whatever, because they're wild. And so actually, our ability to detect what's happening in wild species is pretty poor, particularly, in many parts of the world. But the evidence we have is that bumblebees have probably generally been declining for 50 or 60 years. There's certainly much less, some species have gone extinct, and the species richness, the number of species of bumblebee you can find in any one place has dropped over time. But in terms of their actual numbers, it's really hard to say, year to year exactly what's going on because we don't have any easy way of counting them.
I see. And this talk that goes around, it may not have come to your notice, but at least what we hear, this so-called non-scientific community, is that there is some comments apparently made by the biotech industry that there is ways other than using bees to pollinate plants. Is that really true?
Well, some crops are much less dependent on pollination than others. But at the moment, so far as I am aware, nobody has yet produced an almond tree that doesn't need pollinating. I'm not sure what the alternative would be. I did see a newspaper article recently about robot bees that were being developed, but I think that's a very, very long way in the future.
Yeah, that's a cockamamie story. That's simply not practical, I think.
I don't think so, no. I mean, it seems nonsense. And you imagine the expense and, you know, of trying to replace bees with little robots. That seems completely bonkers.
Yeah, that's true. So if you can explain your line of work or qualification as a, like, are you a microbiologist, molecular biologist?
I've spent 20 years studying bumblebees. I'm an ecologist, really, or an entomologist, or a combination of the two. So my background, I did a PhD on butterflies, and ever since then I've been studying bees, essentially, mainly bumblebees, but I've done a little bit of work with other species of bee, and mainly relating to their conservation and ecology and behavior.
Oh, wonderful. And one more question. You're attached to the University of Sussex, is it?
Sussex, yeah.
So when you did this study with, I believe, one or two more colleagues,
yeah,
is the university, somebody has to fund this experiment, right or not?
So just to clarify, I did the experiment when I was at the University of Stirling. I just moved from Stirling to Sussex.
Oh, I see.
It wasn't funded. It was something that I'd been talking about with my my research group. I don't know whether you know, but Penelope Whitehorn was the first author on the study, and she actually led the work. But we didn't. All I had was a little bit of money left over from another grant, essentially, to employ her for 3 months. And that was all we really needed. It was a relatively short experiment. We managed to persuade one of the companies that rear bumblebee nests to provide us with the nests for free. So it actually didn't cost very much to run at all. But no, I didn't have any external funding for that work.
Oh, I see. You probably are guessing where I'm coming to, in the sense that there is this widening perception that science, as we understand it, is no more neutral, and money is influencing science to be biased in one way or the other, and that's because governments do not fully fund universities anymore, and those who fund have a particular particular agenda that they would like to promote a certain kind of views to support their industry model. You agree?
I certainly, it's an interesting subject, and it's a difficult one to get to the bottom of. Mm. I mean, it's certainly true that, for example, the tobacco industry for many decades funded scientists, and essentially somehow that funding persuaded those scientists to produce results which are now regarded as being essentially fake.
Essentially what?
They made things up, or they tried very hard to find. Essentially, the tobacco industry was trying to claim that smoking didn't cause cancer.
Yes.
And they continued to argue that for half a century after very clear evidence had been put forward by independent scientists showing that, of course, smoking does cause cancer. But they funded a lot of scientists, and those scientists almost invariably failed to find any link with cancer and suggested cancer was due to other things. The reason, of course, I'm mentioning this is it's quite possible, I don't think it's being overly cynical, to suggest that similar things probably go on today. But it's very hard to know. Quite a lot of scientists working on pesticides are funded one way or another by pesticide companies. But whether that makes them, you know, impartial, whether that compromises their impartiality is a matter of opinion, really. It does seem to me that it's not ideal that a scientist, if you're investigating the safety of a pesticide, then you shouldn't be funded by the company that makes the pesticide.
Exactly.
That is an obvious conflict of interest, and it would surely be much, much better if that research were funded independently in some way by government or whoever. Yes, I think that's probably all I can say on that, really.
And okay, that was very good, Dave. Now, to come to this issue of EU deciding to either temporarily or partially ban this group of insecticides called neonicotinoid, based on, among other things, maybe your report, is that a fair statement?
Yes. So I think our report helped, along with some others, to spark sort of renewed interest in this. And so shortly after our study was published, the EU launched an inquiry. They asked the European Food Standards Agency to look into the safety of these insecticides. And it took them about 7 months to conduct a review of all the evidence. And they then announced in January this year that they felt that essentially there were too many poorly quantified risks associated with the use of neonicotinoids to continue using them in the way we were. And they recommended essentially that we should stop using them, particularly on flowering crops, which then led to the EU vote, which initially didn't get passed, but then went to a second vote, and on the second time through it did get passed. But there are still countries, including the UK, interestingly enough, that voted against, and it remains controversial. The other thing worth saying is that it's a two-year moratorium, so it'll expire in 2 years' time. It's not a complete ban in that there are still lots of uses of these chemicals which are being allowed. And it's also worth remembering that, I don't know whether you're aware of this, but neonicotinoids are long-lived chemicals. They persist in soil for many years after they've been applied. So it's very unlikely that in 2 years we would see any dramatic benefit, because there's still going to be lots of them around in the environment. So it's very unclear what was going to happen at the end of the 2 years. There's no clear plan to monitor whether there's any benefit from the ban. Most of us believe that 2 years wouldn't be long enough to see any benefit, even if we were monitoring it, which we're not. So I suspect that in 20 months' time, this whole issue will blow up again, because the EU will have to decide, is it going to renew the ban? Is it going to extend it to all uses of the chemicals? It's not clear that they will have any more evidence to go on in 2 years' time than it did this time round, which seems to be a fairly silly way to proceed, really.
Mm. So are you looking forward to or anticipating a request for more work in this particular line?
Having said we won't know much more, we will know a little bit more, because my group has some funding now from the UK government to investigate certain aspects of this in more detail, specifically relating to bumblebees and how much they're exposed to in the real world, because a lot of the debate has... The agrochemical industry has repeatedly said that essentially lab studies are irrelevant, and the only thing that really... anything that happens in the lab is unrealistic and can't be extrapolated to the field. Which I have to say is a bit of a nonsense argument, because almost all of the great biological discoveries were done in labs. There's a lot to be said for the controlled conditions that one has in labs if you want to understand exactly what's going on. But somehow industry seemed to have brainwashed everyone into accepting that the only way to definitively demonstrate an effect of these pesticides on bees is to do a study entirely in the field. An interesting issue that arises there is that it's almost impossible to have controls in the field, because there's nowhere where there aren't these pesticides to put your control nests. And I suspect industry know that when suggesting that's what needs to be done, because they're asking for something that can never happen, essentially. So we are basically trying to quantify exactly how much real bumblebee nests that spend their whole season out in the field are exposed to. And then the second question will be, is that enough to do them significant harm? And in a year or so's time, hopefully I'll be able to tell you the answer.
Wonderful. That means we should. I should try to stay in touch with you, although you have a very busy life. Tell me, Dave, this other person you mentioned, called Penelope.
Yep.
Who has done some original work on it, and you employed her. So, is she also joining up with your team to do the further study as stipulated?
She is. She's staying in Stirling, but we currently have experiments going on with bumblebee nests up in Scotland and down here in Sussex. And it's quite useful to have, you know, that big geographic spread to enable us to kind of generalize better as to what our results really mean. So, yeah, absolutely.
Oh, that's wonderful. So I'm more or less done for today. But, Dave, I have a last request. That is, the listeners in North America, this podcast is more listened in North America than elsewhere, although it's gradually spreading. So do you have any suggestion for people? Anything you have to add to us listening in?
Yeah, I it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, there are some differences in attitude on both sides of the Atlantic. You know, in the Americas, GM crops are standard, and in Europe, we're very skeptical about them.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not quite sure why there's such a marked difference, but it does seem that this issue is... it's seen as much more important in Europe than it is in the States. I don't really know why that is.
That's because of lack of information. Most of the people don't even know what is GMO or what is all this. It's apathy or, I don't know, lack of information, I would say. So raising awareness is one issue. So do you have anything else to add to the people listening in that whether we should be paying more attention to these issues, that food doesn't automatically arrive in the fridge? You know, there is a long process behind it.
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, I'll just get in a plug. I have a book out on this side of the Atlantic, which is just coming out in a little while on your side of the Atlantic, called The Sting in the Tail, which is, if anyone cares to read it, they will find out a lot more about the lives of bumblebees and other bees and how important they are. But as a general point, I do think we've slightly lost our way. I mean, the word sustainability is bandied around a lot and misused, and it's a bit of a bandwagon, but I do think we've kind of lost sight of you know, the big picture in terms of how we look after the environment. And for me, the increasing reliance on agrochemicals of one sort or another, and kind of factory farming is something which I'm not at all convinced is sustainable in the long term. We've got globally huge problems with soil erosion, with salt buildup in soils. We're running out of phosphates to fertilize fields. We're running out of water in aquifers to irrigate fields. There are a whole heap of aspects of what we're doing on a global scale which we're not going to be able to continue doing. They simply are not sustainable in the very little literal sense that the water or the soil or whatever is running out. So I think people should be really concerned and interested in this, because you know, the future well-being of our children depends on us looking after the environment, and I don't think we're doing a very good job of it right now.
Wonderful. You said something that raises one more question. I'm sorry for dragging you on in this.
No, not at all.
You said that we might be running out of phosphate. So now that prompts an additional question. Why is phosphate necessary?
It's one of the chemicals that you're getting a bee biologist onto slightly unfamiliar territory here, but it's basically one of the essential nutrients, minerals that plants need for growth.
Why do we need it if before industrial agriculture people did it without phosphate one way or another, right?
That's a good question. I guess it's the way that we've intensified agricultural production has increased demand on phosphate. So the small amounts of it that were available from breakdown of minerals in the soil or whatever were probably sufficient for crop production at a low intensity, but not the way we're doing it now.
Oh, I see.
I'm slightly guessing here because this is not my area of expertise.
Okay. And phosphate is something that we are running out of because of phosphorus?
Basically, it sounds like a terribly old-fashioned thing, but guano is one of the main sources of phosphates. And there's only so much of it in the world, and birds aren't producing it, you know, fast enough, anywhere near as fast enough as we're harvesting it.
Oh, I see. So here ended the main part of my talk with him, and I requested Dave to explain something about the book that he's written, and it's about to be published, about bumblebees.
A Sting in the Tail.
A Sting in the Tail, and that's a book that you have written jointly, singly?
Singly. It's a popular book about bumblebees.
Is it a children's book or an adult's book?
An adult book.
An adult book on bumblebees. And it's coming out in North America in 2014.
You'll be able to buy it from Amazon in June, in a couple of weeks' time, though it is being published by an American publisher in 2014, but you'll be able to get it before then from Europe.
So there you have it about the book, A Sting in the Tail. I did check up on Amazon and other sources, and what they are showing is that this book, A Sting in the Tail by Dave Gulson, is now available as an Kindle edition or electronic book edition for Canadian dollar $14.99, and a hardcover edition, probably a paperback edition, will also be out soon. And you will find also some more books by Dave Gulson on Amazon, mostly on bumblebees. And then those who have the iPad, Apple's iPad, and are connected to iTunes bookstore, they can also find the same ebook or electronic book called Sting in the Tail. And I have an iPad, so what I did is I downloaded the sample version of the book. You can download any book, just a few pages of it as a sample, and then after you read it, if you don't like it, you can toss it away, or if you like it, then you can pay for the price and download the complete book. So I did download the sample book already, and I will read the first two paragraphs of that book. And here's what it says. About the book. Dave Gulson has always been obsessed with wildlife. From his childhood menagerie of exotic pets and dabbling in experimental taxidermy to his groundbreaking research into the mysterious ways of the bumblebee and his mission to protect our rarest bees. Once commonly found in the marshes of Kent, the short-haired bumblebee now only exists in the wilds of New Zealand, the descendants of a few queen bees shipped over in the 19th century. Dave Gulson's passionate drive to reintroduce it to its native land is one of the highlights of a book that includes exclusive research into these curious creatures, history's relationship with the bumblebee, and advice on how to protect it for all time. That's what the first two paragraphs of the book says. Having read it, how can you not buy the rest of it? By the way, the electronic version of this ebook on iPad is $14 and something, so it's more or less same whether you buy it from Kindle or from Apple stores, as long as you buy the electronic version. Paperback is not out yet. The hardcover is in the 30s, 33 something. So with that, I'll take your leave and hope to see you next time. Please send me a note of how you like it. I know it's a little bit on the longer side, but the subject is new and subject is important. And there are a lot of things that I didn't know much about. I'm an engineer and not a you know, didn't know much about insects and chemicals and pollination and so on. And it's all been very, not only educative, it's extremely important for everyone to know what's happening with the onset of this relentless drive to industrialize and factory produce everything. So with that, over and out, and see you next time. Bye.